You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
My name is Oliver Ireland. I'm a lawyer with the firm of Morrison & Forrester. Do an extensive information practice, customer information. I used to be with the Federal Reserve Board before I came to Morrison & Forrester and was involved at the Fed in both the Gramm-Leach-Bliley privacy rules and, to a lesser extent, the HIPAA rules as they were being developed. I have with me, in the order we're going to speak after me, Phil Dangio from Director of Sales Life Sciences at VeriSign, Mark McCarthy from Visa, turning to the financial side, and Pat Kane from the anti-phishing work group. Just as we lost Jan Laurie Goldman from Columbia University, who couldn't get down today, so you can listen to the moderator talk for a minute to fill up some of that space. The issue of privacy and data security in both the medical area and in the financial area has grown up really out of competing interests of efficiency and people's instinctual desire for privacy. And the privacy desire has historically, or the privacy concern has historically manifested itself most strongly in the medical and the financial area, and I'll get to a little bit more of that in a minute. Reminded the first time when I was at the Federal Reserve Board, I talked about financial privacy with Alan Greenspan. He said, well, from an economic standpoint, the answer about information and information dissemination is unequivocal. The more information you disseminate, the more efficiently the economy will operate. And his illustration was that if I'm a manufacturer of coats and I have the choice of making red coats or blue coats or red coats and blue coats, and I know in advance that people want blue coats and don't want red coats, I'll only make blue coats. And I'll sell all my coats and I won't have any waste and I'll have the most efficient manufacturing and sales process. If I don't know that and I make red coats instead, I've got a real problem. And if I play it safe and make half and half, I still have something of a problem. So maximum economic efficiency is achieved by maximum dissemination of information. Countervailing that concern for economic efficiency is two things. One of them is that sometimes the dissemination of information results in fraud. And that fraud itself is inefficient, and we've seen issues about that fraud in the area of identity theft, in particular in the last couple of years. In addition, though, there is an immeasurable and intangible concern that individuals have about maintaining control about the over the financial information about them. And in the United States, that has been recognized in case law for financial records at banks in some states going back to the relatively early part of the 20th century. There had been a confidentiality or implied confidentiality clause in many bank contracts in many states arising out of that concern. Medical information, that privacy concern is, if anything, much stronger. There's less of a fraud issue in medical information, but historically the confidentiality of medical information has been a very high priority in individuals' value schemes. In particular, when you get into the HIPAA legislation, what HIPAA was designed for was to improve the efficiency of the handling of health information and claims related to health information, insurance claims, so that the handling of that information could be standardized and transmitted more efficiently, payments made more efficiently, and the whole system not break down in a blizzard of paper, which is what happened in the securities clearing business in Wall Street in the late 1960s, for example. Confronted with an effort, however, to create a more efficient system, HEW, in implementing HIPAA, was concerned that that efficiency itself would begin to hurt individual privacy, because you would have information flowing across electronic systems and perhaps large databases being created, and the potential for loss of privacy of that medical information was increased in their view. And so they added privacy rules, very extensive privacy rules and data use rules, to the basic requirements of HIPAA, based on actually very, very scant legislative language. If you look at the difference, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, in the financial world, you have pretty extensive legislative language, and it's added to a bit by the various rules implementing it, but not orders of magnitude. In HIPAA, they pretty much made up the whole thing out of a few lines in the statute. And it's reflective of this effort to try to balance efficiency and anxiety or concern about privacy. And ultimately, the concern, I think, from a public policy standpoint, as I see it, is that you don't want the privacy concerns to be ignored, but you also don't want the privacy concerns to be so overblown, people to not understand what's going on, to have fears, so that you lose the advantages and the efficiencies of automation and other information dissemination, that it takes place without truly threatening those privacy concerns. Here we have a panel of experts to talk more in detail about what is actually going on in the ground in these industries and the handling of data, particularly online data in the medical world and in the financial world. And I'll turn it now to Phil D'Angio to talk from VeriSign Life Sciences.
Thanks, Ollie. I'm Phil D'Angio with VeriSign's Public Sector Group. We focus a lot of our time in helping banks or healthcare organizations protect their data as well as our data, as I like to say, since it's very much ours as much as it is theirs, to play with on a day-to-day basis. And what I see happening largely over the last year and a half, I've seen a lot of growth around the authentication aspect of users, of entities, et cetera, that have access to data. So I see a lot of focus, not just on the policy side, which is obviously important in complying with good policies and good regulations that are being implemented, but also, you know, from a functional perspective, how can you do that in a way that isn't obtrusive to the end user or to the relying party, whether it be a business partner, an end user like ourselves, trying to get access to our bank account information, our E-Trade account, or our Riggs account, I guess PNC now. I'm still thinking Riggs as a local boy. But most of the if you want my take from a perspective of being out there and learning about what banks, what hospitals, what healthcare organizations like RIOs are really seriously looking at, from a authentication and a security perspective, it's network security, it's access security, it's identifying strongly who the users are. But that's not new. That's not new technology. It's been out there for a while. It's been a want or a must-have for the federal government and the DOD for many years. What's difficult for commercial entities that interface with the general population or with their business partners that are less sophisticated than them to do is to implement that in a way that's transparent or woven into the fabric of their daily interactions with them. And so we've been asked by most of our customers at VeriSign, how can you do this for us easily? How can you make this more of something that's permeating our society? And so we've collaborated a lot with industry players and with our customers to try to make that happen. That, to me, is the largest challenge, is to make this scalable and to make it embedded into our daily activities, but still achieve that level of authenticity and integrity in our transactions. So, yeah, that's sort of an industry take from a perspective of what's happening. Over the last year and a half, I'd say that the focus has primarily been on strongly authenticating users. And then from that point forward, we're going to have, I think, a greater amount of attention paid to fraud protection, which is something that VeriSign has woven into its network capabilities to, you know, detect anomalies in any authenticated user's activity. That's the next wave of focus, because once you strongly authenticate them, can you be sure that that person past the authentication isn't doing something malicious or something suspicious? And if they are, then take them to another level of authentication, which, of course, should be scalable and, of course, shouldn't be so intrusive that they don't want to do the next step. So look for it, because it's coming to you.
Mark?
I want to say a few words about that. Is this thing on?
Yeah.
Say a few words about internet commerce and the role of Visa and the payment card companies there. I guess the good news is that internet commerce is growing. Our numbers from the within the Visa system worldwide showed that internet commerce went up by 27% last year. This is a pretty good rate of growth. We think that's good. We want to maintain it or improve it to the extent that we can. But I think those numbers suggest that those who have said that there are some serious problems with privacy and security concerns on the internet, you know, are perhaps speaking in a kind of counterfactual way. They're saying, boy, if we didn't have any of these worries at all, you know, you wouldn't have 27% growth, you'd have 80% growth. And boy, I'd like to have 80% growth, but 27% is pretty good. So we don't think the channel is in distress. It's not in a circumstance where we're thinking that there's an emergency that needs to be rectified through immediate industry action or governmental action. Still, we do think that the trust in the medium is important, and we're trying to do what we can to make sure that people feel pretty comfortable using their cards on the internet. And data security is clearly one of those issues. We've probably in other contexts distinguished between data security and data privacy. It's one of the important distinctions you've got to make in order to understand consumer reactions in this area. Data security is when the information is kept away from bad people who want to take it and use it for bad purposes. It's unauthorized access to information. Privacy really relates to a different kind of problem. You've got the information. You're a business. You're a government. Whatever, and you want to use it for some purposes that perhaps people think is an intrusion on their private sphere of life, and they don't like you using the information for that particular purpose. But you didn't steal it. You got it through the normal course of business processes and business events. When you do the surveys, it turns out people are very, very concerned about privacy. And if you don't distinguish the issues for them, they run privacy in together with data security, and you get a kind of confused result that says 99% of the people are concerned about the internet because of privacy problems. When you probe a little bit more carefully, which we've done in some of our surveys, you find out that people are far more worried about unauthorized access to their information than they are about people getting the information and using it for purposes such as marketing that they may feel to be inappropriate. So the steps we're taking to focus on resolving the trust issues in the internet really focus on the security issues. Years ago, I would say in the late 1990s, internet commerce was just taking off, and there were a lot of new players in the marketplace. There were these new databases that were created by the new entrepreneurs that were internet-facing because the commerce was internet in character. And not all of the new entrepreneurs did what they should do to keep the information safe and secure. They were rushing to build their business. They were rushing to understand their market. They were rushing to improve the processes whereby they distributed the product to their consumers. But the data security wasn't at the top of their list. And yet the Internet was an open public system, so these databases that faced the Internet were at some risk. And you may remember there were some unpleasant public stories about Internet merchants who were victimized by thieves and who faced difficulties with the continuation of their business because the publicity, the adverse publicity, suggested that they weren't a reliable or trustworthy business partner. This was a concern for Visa at the time, and we knew that there were things that could be done to improve security in the area, but many of these new merchants didn't really focus on them and didn't really pay attention to them. So we developed what we called our cardholder information security program back in the late 1990s. It became effective in the early 2001. It was designed to be a comprehensive information security program. It's all on the Internet. You can go see it. It's not secret. www.visa.com/CISP, KISP. All the information is there, including the famous digital dozen rules for keeping information safe and secure. That was developed, you know, with the target of these Internet merchants in mind. But it was developed in a comprehensive fashion to apply to anybody who would store, process, or transmit cardholder data. That was the intent. It was a refinement of some of the ISO standards that were out there and made specific to the particular case of cardholder information. Enforcement, we initially in the early years, in the 2001, 2002, we focused on Internet commerce merchants. They were the ones, as I said, who seemed to be needing the advice and the guidance. And so we looked at the top 100 Internet merchants who generated about 70% of our volume. And, you know, they got it real quick. What they needed was the information and the shove. And very, very quickly, the Internet community became compliant with the CISP, the KISP program, moving forward to ensure that the data there was safe and secure. Enforcement has now moved to all those who store, process, and transmit cardholder information. Many of you have been familiar with the data breaches in the last year or so. The names are probably familiar, CSSI, DSW, BJ's, and so on. Most of the examples that I just mentioned, in fact, all of the big ones, were not Internet merchants. They were offline merchants. They were or processors who handled both transactions for the offline world and the online world. There have been a number of FTC actions in that area. They've gone after BJ's. They've gone after DSW. And most recently, they had an enforcement action against ChoicePoint. So these are issues where the need for across-the-board enforcement on good data security is something that people are paying more and more attention to. The second point I want to make, that was actually just the first point. The second point that I wanted to make was that the Internet is not a riskier channel for people who are shopping on the Internet. You may have heard, well, fraud is more widespread on the Internet. The fraud rates for people who shop on the Internet are so much higher than for people who shop in regular retail stores. And that, of course, is true. But stop and think about what that statistic means. It means that when people want to commit fraud, they go on the Internet to commit the fraud. If you've got a card number, right, and an expiration date, but you don't have the card itself, you're not going to be able to go to a retail merchant, hand them a card, and commit fraud. You've got to go to a circumstance where the card doesn't have to be present. So that means you go to the Internet. So the fraudsters are naturally going to go to the place where it's easier to commit fraud, so you're going to have higher rates of fraud on the Internet no matter what. That does not mean that a person who goes shopping on the Internet transmits the card information across the Internet and has the information stored in an Internet-facing database is at any further risk of problems than someone who goes to his local 7-Eleven or Safeway or Circuit City and buys something using the card in a face-to-face context. There are steps people can take to protect themselves with respect to online transactions, and let me mention a few of them. If you're a merchant, a very easy fraud prevention tool is what we call our address verification service. This is a service where, and some of you probably are familiar with this, please enter your billing address when you go online to shop or something. They are able to send that billing address information through the Visa network, and they will check to make sure that that's the correct billing address. If you're dealing with a fraudster who doesn't have the accurate address, who just wants it sent to a post office box or something like that, you know, they won't be able to pass that particular test. The other verification that's often used is that they ask you for the security code on the back of the card. Right, say, please type in the 3-digit security code. It's on the back of the card. That's designed to protect against those circumstances where the fraudster has gotten hold of the cardholder information. Right, they've maybe even skimmed the card at a restaurant. So they've got the card number. They've got the expiration date, but they don't have the card. And if they don't have the card, it's hard to turn it over and look at those three digits and put them into the box on the Internet. So that can be done. The third are verified by Visa service, which is it's a PIN-based service where merchants can sign up for it, issuing banks can sign up for it. And what it does is when the transaction is about to be completed, instead of just hitting the button that says sold, you hit that button, and what pops up is a screen that asks you to enter your PIN number, your verified by Visa PIN number. A communications channel is open to the issuer. The issuer says, yes, that's the right person, sends a message back to the merchant saying this is the right person, and the transaction is further authenticated through that mechanism. We're going to have a demonstration at the tech fair, those of you who are going to be around, from 5 to 7 in the floor here, from 5 to 7. Verified by Visa will be there on display for you to use. We have Mike Yackel, who will be able to tell you in great detail all the advantages and benefits of this wonderful authentication system which we use online. So that's my story. I'd be happy to, you know, have a further discussion and questions after the rest of the panelists have had a chance to talk.
Pat, can you tell us something about phishing?
I was going to do something exciting, actually.
Oh.
my name is Pat Kane. I'm here on behalf of the Anti-Phishing Working Group, which is a collection of about 2,500 companies and governments and law enforcement agencies whose goal is really to share information. And sharing information in two different directions, one of which is we have semi-annual meetings where people get together and we kick out the press and we try to be friendly, and people kind of exchange ideas on how they stopped fraud happening at their place, or how they got the cops to pay attention to them, or the cops come in and give us the, here's how we caught the guys that you yelled at us about 6 months ago, which has actually been very useful, and it provides a nice network of let's figure out what's really going on. We also have something which is finally known as a repository, which is if you actually have got a phish or a crimeware or a malware or something and you don't know what to do with it, you can send it to, I think it's phishing@antiphishing.org, and it goes into our repository. And repository has some automated things on it that can actually go back and tell the person or the organization who's being phished that, hey, by the way, you don't know this, but there's people out there phishing for you. Or there's people attacking your customers or things like that. Because a lot of the phishing and fraud stuff, the organization who actually is being phished won't know about it until it's too late. The repository has about 90,000 entries in it now. So it also gives law enforcement an ability to go in and search on stuff to see if the same guy's doing things and stuff like that. But we're purely a volunteer organization. That being said, we don't get to see the good side of all this stuff. We only see the bad things. So I get what we call the catch of the day every day, which is the latest in phishing techniques. And I really wish I had the time that these guys spent trying to get around security stuff that we see, because somebody spends months or a couple weeks trying to get around some of the Visa controls and some of the VeriSign controls and some of the things we've seen, signed, secured email that validates just fine, but Citibank wasn't in China last I looked. We see things that, you know, the little emails that say type your stuff here, everybody ignores, and so the phishers are morphing into more and more bizarre stuff with keystroke loggers and stuff like that. That being said, the question that the panel got hit with was, you know, should consumers trust their financial and medical records online, and are they reaping the benefits of any of that stuff? And I think the short answer is they're already reaping it, because I live in Boston. I got on a plane this morning. I came down here and went, boy, it'd be nice to have some fare for the metro. Took my great little ATM card with the Visa logo on it and stuck it in a local ATM. And because most of my bank account information is in some big database, it spit out money at me. And I took that as a great reaping of the system. Same thing would happen if I say something bad and when you stabs me and I go over to the local hospital, they're going to be able mostly to type in some numbers about me and probably find out that there's some things they shouldn't give me because it's going to kill me, or that I have medical information or I have medical insurance and all those kind of things. And so I think consumers are actually reaping the benefits of of the digitalization of all this stuff. We actually think there's three kind of challenges left, though, because in the old days, if I wanted to take some money out of the bank, I would go to my friendly little bank people and I'd say, I want to send $100,000 to my good buddy in Russia. And the little lady would look at me and kind of go, yeah, I don't think so. We need to think about this a little more. And so there was this kind of human element in it where somebody could look at the real fishy stuff. Right now, because everything is online and it happens very quickly, I go to Bank of America and I hit the button that says send $100,000 to some guy in Russia, and the bank says, sure, no problem. And so we've lost the ability for the human smarts part to be put in the middle there. The second problem is a lot of this, you know, letting the users go and look at their own records or get access to their own records somehow, causes the users to be confused, and they do stupid things because the internet was based on the let's see how hard we can make it to work, and that's still true. A lot of people do the, we have this really fancy security thing, and boy, this is so wonderful, and our users are being protected by it. And then last spring, there was a story and an adventure in London where a guy was giving out candy bars if you give him his bank passwords. And he ran out of candy bars pretty quick, which is a bad sign. It means we're confusing the users. So while all this stuff is there and we're given that access, the users are still confused. And then there's kind of a third piece, which is there's competitive pressures to not actually let all this stuff happen. So I may get some of my bank information, but I may not get all of it because the bank doesn't want to tell everybody else about it. Or my medical records may get transferred from one doctor to another doctor, maybe with some stuff missing because they know some stuff that they don't want to just give over because it took them some money to make that those decisions about me. And so there's this whole competitive landscape you always have to deal with. So I think that the big challenge is not in the technology anymore. There's great technology. Both these guys have things that can tell you how great the technology is. We're back onto the people and processes piece. If you're here before, I asked a silly question about Boston Globe, who was nice enough to print out 240,000 credit card numbers and CCVs and names and addresses and recycle it out into their distribution network. So there's 240,000 people that are kind of now lost up in Boston. People are jumping up and down and saying, oh, my God, you know, what happened? Did they respond properly and all that? You know, I'm a security guy. I raise my hand and say, why the hell did they print out 240,000 credit card numbers on paper? So what are they going to do with these? And so it's a process thing. It's not a technology thing. It's a go back into the companies and do a, if you want people to trust you, you have to change your processes. And we see this repeatedly. A lot of the big breaches have no criminal intent really in it. It ends up being, you know, the stupid meter. The guy just did something stupid. And it's really hard to actually get people to trust you when you say, hi, we hire stupid people.
Thank you. It seems to me that the technology to deal with various types of fraud is basically there, and we can get into that more if people would like. But let me step back for a minute, and because I really think this is a people issue and a competence issue. We don't have that big a group here, so we can do a little survey. How many people here? We're all consumers here. Have not done a transaction, a commercial transaction, buy something because they were concerned about their privacy in connection with doing that transaction. Relatively few.
You mean there was only one instance where
you didn't go forward because you were worried about it, because it was potential, you thought your name, information would get out, there would be fraud, or information about the transaction would get out. Privacy and security are very difficult to segregate. How many of those cases were on the internet or in electronic transactions as opposed to face-to-face transactions? Permit? The question is, was the transaction internet, face-to-face, or did it make a difference?
Well,
If you did it, a show of hands, who had a bigger problem with the internet than in face-to-face trends? How many of those people who had a problem with the internet transaction actually had any idea what this comparative security between the internet transaction was and the face-to-face transaction? Well, we have a number of people. And did you, any of those people that have their hands up, did they really think that the internet was less secure way to conduct a commercial transaction than to give it to somebody in a store?
The one we chose not to use?
Yeah.
Yes. The cues that I might have had in the offline world, right? I go into a bargain basement looking store in Times Square and it's going out of business and there's a bunch of cameras and you look kind of busty and but they got a great brand name now. I use all these cues that I've grown, right, that we all are comfortable with to say, it's like kind of a gray market thing, maybe it won't work, maybe I'm getting ripped off here. I go to Google and I look at these 100 places and there are a couple of them, oh, they got this kind of really cheap, but I don't have all the cues to know whether, well, who the hell is this? Is this some bad guy suspicion? So I'm not making the assessment based on, and I understand it when I give my credit card to some unknown waiter in a restaurant, but I'm like, it's a nice restaurant, it looks like a classy place, I'm probably, you know, I understand the guy might be a crook and it might have hired this yesterday, but I use all these cues that I don't yet know how to assess on the internet without help.
As an aside, just because you used the word camera, there is a guy who goes off and searches for the lowest prices in New York City on cameras and then drives over with a digital camera, takes a picture of the building, and then puts it up on his website. So that if you want better cues of, boy, I want to see what the building looks like, you can go to a place now and actually look and see if they have a building. And it's kind of a scary proposition to see where you buy stuff from.
A famous plug is, you know, we look for the VeriSign logo, you look for or Visa, or, you know, there's a secure logo, you look for the little lock symbol. Those of us who actually understand how to read certificates actually sometimes look and check, the, you know, check and see if the certificate's up to date. Some of us are geeks, I know. But, you know, there are, and Joel, being the smartest guy in the room probably right now, is right, there's cues. We all go for those cues, and those of us who know more, look for the telltales. When you don't get them, that's when you eject.
And the good point there is that, you know, there aren't many Joels out there. Most of the folks using the internet aren't going to be aware of how well to do a certificate is on eBay versus XBay, right? So, you know, that's just the real world. Like, so you're never going to be able to take the human element out of it. And it really is the elephant in the room, right? You know, that's the problem with internet commerce is that, you know, we've built in so much security at the browser level, at the back end level, back through the Visa network. I mean, the Visa network rides the VeriSign network, et cetera. So, you know, we're talking about serious open communication about what's happening in these transactions and bringing integrity to them from the B2B side. But at the commerce level, at the consumer level, I mean, you know, you still need to be a little bit weary of what you're doing, you know, from a human level.
You got a comment all the way in the back?
I was actually just going to ask him if he felt that was government's responsibility, like FTC or FCC, or if that's industry's responsibility to do it. Because you're right, user awareness is the issue. We don't have knowledgeable people. For every one knowledgeable person, we probably have 3 dozen unknowledgeable people. So my question would just be...
I tend to think it's probably both. But, you know, for companies, it's pretty simple. Or for any healthcare organization, I deal with hospitals and healthcare systems on a daily basis, as well as financial institutions. They know that if something happens with their data, the data that they use on a daily basis on their websites, they know if something happens to that, it's going to hit the paper, and they're going to be out of business. So you can be sure that they feel responsible for adding an extra layer of security and continuing to improve security well above what's going on with the fraudsters that are out there. And that's really where the problem is the fraudsters. I mean, it's really not about somebody taking your credit card and using it on another website. I mean, Visa insures your credit card. I don't think we're really ever stopping to use our credit card because we're worried about the site. It doesn't happen because if something was fraudulent about my transaction, there's insurance behind it. No credit card today that you get isn't insured for internet commerce. So your identity is really what you're really trying not to lose, and you really can't lose that per se in an internet secured internet transaction.
Thanks, Oliver. Mark, when you were discussing the identity theft, and on the last panel we talked about the fact that last year we had $55 billion in ID theft costs. $50 billion of that was borne by businesses, retailers, and your merchandise. Mm-hmm. And only $5 billion of that, which is still a lot, was borne by consumers. So I think businesses have an incentive to increase the ability that they can authenticate that the credit card customer mm-hmm. is real, or that before you let them open a charge account or install a loan account, that they are who they say they are. Mm-hmm. That would seem to provide plenty of incentives for companies to spend more money to fill on authentication.
Well, and yet, two years out,
will consumers doing business with Amazon online, will they have a different level of authentication
yes.
than just the card ID and the app? And will businesses spend the money?
First of all, our fraud rate is pretty low. This has been a problem we've been dealing with ever since we've had a credit card operation. Initially the fraud rate was reasonably high. It was 20 to 30 basis points. It's now down to 5 basis points, 6 basis points, depending on which month we're looking at. And that's been a result of pretty heavy investments in information technology and in neural networks that can detect patterns that are not your patterns, that are different patterns, and in the different kinds of expenditures that can increase security. Now, there was an economic reason why the card companies did that. They weren't just being nice. They did this because the way federal rules have been set up since the 70s, the liability for unauthorized transactions has been moved away from cardholders. If something goes wrong with your credit card or your debit card, it's used in a fashion that you did not authorize, you, under federal law, have limited liability. The bulk of the liability for unauthorized use has always been moved away from the cardholder to the financial institutions. Well, we'll get to that in a second. The federal rules did that as a result of competition, not because the government dictated it. Visa moved to a zero liability policy. We did this in the early late 1990s, and it was competitive. We didn't do it first. One of our competitors moved in that direction, and we said we can't allow that to happen. We are not going to allow another card brand to create a perception that they're more responsive to consumer concerns, more protective of consumer interests than Visa. So we jumped on and we followed them, and the other card companies followed. So competition increased the level of consumer protection through the normal forces of us wanting to be the preferred brand. But that gave us an even bigger incentive to make sure that we had the right sort of fraud protection systems in place, because if something goes wrong, it's not the cardholder who's going to pay. Interestingly, when cardholder information is stolen, it's not the retailer who pays it. I mean, the fraudster gets a card, he steals a card or makes a counterfeit card. He goes to Circuit City, he buys something, right? The Circuit City gets paid. Right? They didn't do anything wrong, right? They took the card the way they're normally supposed to take the card. They got a signature. They sent it through our system for authentication. They did everything right. They get paid. Right? The people who don't get paid in that circumstance are the bank that works with the cardholder, right? The cardholder's bank, the issuing bank. Now, somebody in the system has to pay for the fraud. That's the one who in our system tends to be the fall guy. But we have had to, because of the circumstance, we've had to put the fraud detection systems in there. And if you look at the pattern over a period of time, it's been successful. It's worked. We've been able to reduce the fraud down to 5 or 6 basis points. That's 5 or 6 cents for every $100. Whether we're going to get better or different, always. I mean, this is an evolving industry. This is not something where the fraudsters are going to say, okay, I give up. Visa's won. They're going to say, there's a new way of doing something that'll be different that you haven't thought of, and they'll think of something that we'll then have to respond to. So to answer your question, what's going to happen in the next couple of years? Yeah, there's going to be more stuff that people will have to be involved in. As I said at the end of the talk, the system we've got in place is a kind of authentication system where people enter a special PIN verified by Visa number. We think that's going to spread. It's probably going to be the way people will be shopping on the Internet when they use their Visa cards over the next several years. And we think more and more people will choose to do that. They'll feel more protected. Merchants will feel more protected. We think that's kind of the wave of the future.
It definitely is. I'll add to what Mark's described there is VeriSign and other industry groups have partnered with the eBays of the world and some of the mutual fund companies and mortgage banking companies that do business over the web recently to have a higher level of authentication for merchants that are on eBay that so want to have that so wish to have a higher level of authentication other than user ID and password, which is obvious because I'm not comfortable logging into my bank account with user ID and password. I wish they had something else, a token, something else that I could present that I had to have, not just know. So right now, and you can check the press in the next week and a half, you're going to see a lot of press releases from VeriSign and other industry players on the web talking about that second layer of authentication and how it's going to be delivered to you, what it can cost, etc. It's very cost effective, and we didn't do it without asking our potential customers whether or not they'd pay us $5 or $10 for that token. They said yes, they would. So you're going to see more and more of that. When I said it's coming to you, it is. And if you want to see what that solution is and what it means to have a token and how it would interact with your daily life, we'll have that demo this afternoon as well.
The one part, I'm sure that people are going to change the way they log in over the next couple of years, but I don't think it's going to be the type of things that these guys kind of talk about, because as you get to be a pretty good consumer on the Internet, the brand owner is going to want to keep you there. And they're going to come up with some creative ways to keep you here. Amazon's One Click is a great example. If Barnes & Noble decided to come up with 3/4 of a click, you know, a big chunk of people would move over. And you see this in banks already. One of the discussions that some of the banks had, I was a technical guy on an anti-phishing, anti-fraud thing with 70 banks, and it was all the big banks. And the big thing that came out of that was, if we make it too hard for the customers to mm-hmm. deal with us, they're going someplace else.
That's right.
And so one guy from one big bank said, we're using this bizarre little thing, and you got to type those things in. And another big bank went, we got two less buttons. We're doing pretty good. And another guy popped up and said, we found this online thing that our fraud rates don't seem to be going too bad. We're going to use that and screw the little token things. And somebody else said, I got a couple of really important customers, and they have accounts at all your banks. I need to figure out how to generate those numbers for them because I want to make sure they stay with me. And so we can talk about tokens. We can talk about stuff. But the brand owner has this problem that says, how do we deal with authentication enough to save some of my stuff and make the regulatory people believe we're doing something, but not scare our highly qualified and technical user base away? I mean, everybody in here is probably 90% better at e-commerce and looking at my medical records and typing in the right little verified by Visa thing the first or second time than 99.6% of the U.S. population.
There's no doubt that that is the problem. Most folks will tell you that, you know, the regulatory compliance or the guidance from FFIEC, which is telling banks, hey, you got to have more than a user ID and password to log into your bank account, says you have to have a second factor of authentication, meaning the token things that people hate. And I wouldn't want to have another thing on my keychain if I didn't have to. So what do you do about that?
It doesn't say that.
It doesn't.
No,
I must say, I've talked to several of the agencies. That guidance does not suggest that you have to have a separate type of that factor. It says you should use layered authentication, but it doesn't mean that you have to have a token or a fingerprint along the way. It can be read that way, but I don't think that's the right reading.
I think that they've built in some flexibility there, and some of the banks are moving in that direction. Some credit unions, Bank of America, they've got this system where you choose a picture when you go there, and then that becomes your picture when you go back and you don't see the picture. You know, you're not at the right place. That's not two-factor authentication in any technical sense, but it's an increased layer of security, and that's exactly the kind of thing that the regulators were looking for. So show some movement in the marketplace. Do something that won't scare people away, but it'll show that you're taking this phishing problem a little bit more seriously and more comfortable. So we don't think of it as a mandate for using specific techniques. And I think the flexibility it leaves in the marketplace is good, because I think ultimately, you know, you're right, the marketplace is going to evolve a lot of different clever ways of dealing with this, and you don't want the regulators to say, no, we've picked on this one, you've got to use it.
Mark, just a quick question, follow-up. Where would you put chargebacks, the number of basis points, fraudulent chargebacks, relative to everything else?
I'll have to get back to you on that. I knew the numbers years ago, and I just don't have them. It took my time.
Well, we're starting to run out of time. The other question I was going to ask, but the panel has beaten me to it, was how many people have either not done a transaction because the level of authentication or the level of security to do it was more than they wanted to bother with, or not availed themselves of security that was provided in connection with their credit card or other payment device, and gone ahead and accept and done a riskier transaction than they could have done, accepting that risk out of convenience.
You may want to add a third piece to it. It may just be a technical piece, which is people who play with the system. There are people who, merchants who say, you know, you have to give us all this information. And so I'm like, I live at 1602 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. I'll give you a zip code. It's great. You want a phone number? 800-555 something or other. Hey, look, the transaction went through. I don't care. It's not something important. It's not something I'm expecting to go back to. And I really just don't want them to spam me anymore with more crap. And so, you know, my Bank of America site key, I have a whole bunch of accounts, and it pops up you should put a picture like, you know, a dog on it. Like, I got dogs. Like, I don't care. I know what's happening behind the scenes. This doesn't matter.
That hits home. I get mail at my house for people with strange names, and I was once remarking on it. And my wife said when she goes into stores and places and they ask her who she is, sometimes she gives them address and she gives them a screwy name, and sometimes she gives them a screwy address, and we wind up getting mail for those things. What?
and even in the non-online thing, about 10 years ago, I went to cash a check at a local merchant, and they gave me this little 3x5 card to put out that was, where do you work, how long you been there, what's your boss's name, how much money in your bank account, what the bank account number is, all the credit card details for these two things. And I looked at him and said, well, boy, you know, this is really hard. And I said, do I need a pencil or something? And she turned around to this little 3x5 box that was sitting right next to the door and kind of flipped through all the filled-out cards and found some stuff and gave it to me. And I'm like, boy, I feel really good. And so I took the easy approach. I took the card and shoved it in my pocket and pulled out my Visa card.
There you go.
And let them pay the 5% handling fee. Because it was, you want my entire life on this little card that's going to sit by the door, downtown Boston. Yeah, I feel we are very comfortable with this. And so the same thing now happens online is the guy wants this information. You start off with the why. And then if I figured out that, well, they really need it for something, then it's, do I trust them not to screw it up too bad?
Well, we've run out of time. I've been asked to remind you that there is a reception up in the Dirksen Senate office building in room SDG 50. And the Dirksen office building is just a short walk from here, and that starts at 5 o'clock. And I thank you all, and thank my panel.
Yes. Thank you.
It's good.
Mark, good to meet you.
As always.
We love you.